Mike Waite with Clinch Northwest.
Clinch Northwest.
Yeah, thank you for coming in today. You've come a long way. We're in St. Louis, and you've come in from the Seattle area, or Seattle proper.
Seattle proper. Clinch Northwest is right next to University of Washington.
Okay, yeah. Well, what does Clinch Northwest do?
Clinch Northwest is a manufacturer of sheet metal fasteners, precision sheet metal fasteners, with our primary product being Clinch Engineering Fasteners. And you ask, what is a Clinch Engineering Fastener? Now, we manufacture fasteners that clinch into sheet metal. And this is a commodity that's business to business, and it's used in light gauge metal, which is what you do. And it's one of those commodities that's everywhere and nowhere. It's surrounding your life with these products. And they clinch into sheet metal, and they typically hold electronics, so any electronic box. But we sell into transportation, trucking, computer, gaming, like companies, slot machines.
Everywhere.
It's everywhere. Everywhere. And so we sell to primarily domestic manufacturers, but we are selling it to Mexico and into Canada, and really just sort of the Americas in general right now. So,
how long have you guys been around?
In our current form, since 2016, Clinch Northwest.
Okay.
So we were born in 2016. We're ISO certified, so we have the certification of being, you know, a quality procedural company.
Yeah.
And then our factories are TS-16949 certified, so that is automotive certs and trucking. And so we really pride ourselves on quality.
Okay.
And as you know, that any product is quality, price, and delivery. And so once you have all three of those, you can rock the boat, and which is what we do.
Yeah. No, I think that it's the constant interplay between those three things of time, cost, and quality. And, you know, it's kind of like the example of if you needed to get a house today, you would probably pay more given a set of features that you need. But if you had a long time to go buy that house, you'd pay way less. You know, so it's kind of like how much time do you have is going to inform how much you're going to pay a premium for the quality, or, you know, it was going to inform the price.
Yeah, we're unique in that way, in that as a manufacturer, we sell consumer direct. And a lot of our competitors have to run through distribution. And what's funny is that, and I don't know if this is a pricing model that we'll use forever, because we are picking up so much distribution work. Like, that's one of our fastest growing markets. And mostly because within the space of the self-clinching fastener, we're very vertically integrated. I've got 1,000 different call-outs in stock on our shelf.
Really?
Now, and the person who's going to use that is the sheet metal fabricator. And the person who's a job shop, who's doing product, you know, day in, day out, doesn't know which project's coming in. I need 1,000 of these today and 5,000 of something else the next day. And, you know, so they're all over the map. And the distributors that buy from us, they are they're horizontally integrated in terms of, okay, we're helping somebody produce a product, and we're going to provide everything for them.
Yes.
So we were doing something for, I don't know if I could talk about companies, but let's say Peterbilt Trucks and Dynacraft, who's making products for their trucks.
Yes.
And so we've got we were selling directly to them, which came in as a legacy product. And we just got picked up by one of their distribution companies, who I think is also doing that. Now, they're going to pay more by going through this distribution rather than buying from us, but I don't know if it's because the buyer's so busy or whatever, but who knows, you know. As I've been told, I'll sell to the devil if he pays on time, but I mean, I'm, you know.
I know what you mean.
I wouldn't do that, but I mean, it's, you know.
Well, right. I mean, I get what you're saying, which is, you know, look, if it's going out our door and you know, people are paying on time, and perhaps maybe it's not the devil, but pretty
right,
pretty close.
you
much don't care.
Yeah.
And so I was a buyer for a long time, and there is something true about buying it all from one place. And it's what I found when I was in projects. So you're supplying to these major plants that are being built. It becomes less about, over time, about the price of the material and things like that. They want someone to actually run that project for them. I mean, I became their internal project manager over time. They'd be like, okay, how much of this have we used And when do we need to order more? Or I'd be proactively saying, hey, you're about to use everything. Do you want me to get more of it for you? So they're really leaning on, I mean, these are very large scale, but really looking to you to help keep their shit straight. And that has a lot of value to them.
It's high value. I see that a lot, especially in the bigger companies. So they actually have employees in-house helping them manage their flow.
Yeah, and it helps them a lot. And that's when the world of change orders really gets sweet, is because, you know, you, perhaps out of the gate, you've quoted something a little bit lean to get the deal, but they do have a dependency grows upon how well you're keeping something organized. And when they have a change order, you know, they're just like, hey, if I don't have to think about it and the shit is here tomorrow, I really don't care.
Right.
It's kind of the reality of it.
Companies like Fastenal will go in and they'll super low bid these projects, and then there's change orders, and oh, we're going to tack that on. Huge margin. Huge. And so that also needs to be managed. But
it does need to be managed. But in that time and place, as we're going to talk about digital today, pricing opacity wouldn't have mattered too much at that point, because it's more that they are going to view it as worth the added money, because I know that this person still got me as far as, I mean, you know, we're talking millions and millions of dollars that are being sort of managed by this rep of a distribution company.
True.
And they're like, we're so far into this at this point. And if you walked away, you know, it's like your drummer bailing on tour. You just like, you can't do that.
Can't do that.
You were clear not, I mean, you didn't want to be abusive about it, because you want to get their next project. So you're really more focused on, let's get them through this as sort of, we want them looking good on the other side.
I've had people say that when I first got into the business, like, Mike, you can charge more. And I said, you know, I charge a fair margin. I don't want to gouge anybody, but I also want to be the low-cost solution.
Yeah.
So, and people know me as that. And I think I mentioned when we talked earlier that people call me their secret weapon. I've had buyers say, I'm not telling anybody about you because you're my secret weapon.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you talk about, and this is the reason I started this company. You know, I was working for the big brother of the industry in this, and the margins were fantastic. And when they offshored a lot of their capacity, they raised the price. And so I said, and all these companies were closing all these big production runs, and it was really kind of sad. And I saw a huge contraction of the manufacturing industry. And one of the largest sheet metal shops, one of the salesmen at the largest sheet metal shops in the Pacific Northwest, Doug Harvey, said, hey, Mike, I can't even get the bill of materials for what we're getting finished product in a box out of China. And I said, you know, all the automation in the world isn't going to help you if you can't start on a level playing field. And that's sort of what I'm all about, and is making sure that we can get products so America can make made in America again.
Yeah.
You know, really, I mean, you know, if you talk about and you talk about all the tariffs that are going on and, you know, we don't have the resources to get aluminum. Canada does. Why are you putting a big tax on that? You know, it's crazy. Why? It's the same reason. But what about coffee? We cannot grow coffee in America. Why are we putting a tariff on that? So,
what are your thoughts on the tariffs?
Well, I think they're terrible.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, it's free. It's a free market. What we produce in America is intellectual capital, intellectual property, intellectual. You know, we got to get the brightest minds in the world to create the greatest products in the world. And if we can manufacture them here, outstanding. Through automation, yes. But we're going to need raw materials. We're going to need low intellectual property items. We're going to need products that are going to help us do that. Mm-hmm. And we can't do it alone. So free markets should be just that, free markets. And if we have the power behind all this, we should be able to do it. So yeah. We should be able to manufacture here, you know, but it should be on equal footing with getting metal like from your company or getting fasteners from my company that are on the same level that you can get wherever else in China, in Taiwan, in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability for us to do that. And there's automation. I sell automated solutions. And as a matter of fact, I'm working with a company right now in Seattle. They're called King Electric. They make all the baseboard heaters that you see.
Yeah.
And they were like, we need an automated solution so we could rivet our assemblies together. And I happened to do that for a company that I distribute for called Rivet King. And okay. So they've got these, have you seen like a nail gun on a spool where they ka-chunk? You could do that with rivets too.
Okay.
And so they are really excited about that. We're coming in, we're doing demonstration. Tack time, which is the amount of time it takes to do an assembly to bring that in. And well, we could put it all together here, and we could put it together with automation, and we could get it out the door. And what does that do? That takes down your time that you have to hold on to inventory, or where it's on a ship, and your lead times by bringing it in. Yeah.
Speed is so important. It informs much of what we do. So tariffs, if your crystal ball, which I know you don't have in front of you right now, but, you know, how does all this shake out in your opinion in maybe the next year, 3 years, 5 years?
Well, because of where we're at and so much uncertainty, I mean, I think that it's going to be harmful until we get an idea of what's going to actually happen with this. A 90-day pause, that's great. You know, I had stuff that I'm bringing over that I told customers, hey, man, price is going up. Now the price is going down. Nobody knows what's going on at the high end of this tariff deal. And so it's going to create volatility. It's also going to shake consumer confidence. And so I feel, which I'm not an expert, that it's going to be harmful.
Right.
So and when all this went into play at the beginning, I said, my prices are going up because my costs are going up.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and that's for manufacturing. And so the product is going up. It's all going up.
Yes.
That cost goes on to the consumer. And I don't think that's what people understand about tariffs necessarily. They think it's like this great thing, but it's not.
Well, I would say that there's a lot to be said for the way that something's done as well, meaning that I think a tariff in itself, maybe it's not an inherently bad thing, but I think maybe the prescription of tariff is an important thing to consider, meaning shutting all down at once is going to have a different effect than maybe a more surgical application of the concept. But like you just said, the amount of information that I would say I'm privy to on this topic is really low, meaning that I can read anything anyone else can read, but what percentage of that is A, true, and B, comprehensive? So it's hard to say, but if you take it, it depends on where you fall. It's sort of like the emotional spectrum of this, which is if there really are these levels of imbalances that exist, and I can't firsthand verify any of this shit, because I don't have that level of clearance. But if these exist, if these truly exist, they'll exist for one way or another, either for diplomacy reasons or because bad deal reasons. I don't know why. But if they do exist, it does seem like looking into those imbalances is a worthwhile endeavor. Now, the question is, to me, is if you're going to put together a concept to bring all of this back into balance, there are a couple of things that I think need to be done really well. And I don't know if those are being done really well. One is the messaging of like, this is, we're thinking about this like the church, like this is a long plan. And this is not a one-term president plan. This is like, if this gets thrown into the trash at midterms, it just would have been pain for naught. Right. Like, so if you can't finish this job, it will have just been pain. And secondly, how do you, it's so important. I brought this up before, the idea behind, you know, FDR during World War II, it was so good at getting people to contribute, like Liberty Gardens, bring your medal down. Like everyone clearly understood, because there was something you could really point to, understood why this near-term sacrifice made sense. And I think that's something that's missing as well. And I think that ties back to maybe an overall sort of polarity that's occurring. But I don't know the answer. All I can say is, as a marketplace in the metals industry, we see these behavioral sort of ups and downs that are occurring. driven by the economics. Agreed.
It is bringing industry back to the U.S. It is. Mm-hmm. And so there is that, but it's also, and maybe that's what it took to extract some of that work back out of China. So we'll see, although a lot of people are already moving to Vietnam or moving to other places where the cost of labor is essentially nothing anyway. So,
It's not exactly the spirit of it, right?
But
markets are smart and markets find a way.
As they say, follow the money, right?
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's what you're going to find is some very good craftiness that is within the rules of the game that markets find a way.
Yeah,
they do. And the thing I think about let's fast forward in our heads a little bit, and okay, fine, we don't have all of this stuff coming in from overseas. It's no longer economically viable to do it. Let's say that is truly something that becomes a constant. We have a demand that's going to far exceed our production capacity.
100%.
How do we get ahead of filling that void of there's a demand here. Are we all just supposed to slow down and just not need that shit anymore? What do you do?
Yeah. There's a couple of ways to think about this. Uh-huh. As Americans, do we overconsume? Absolutely. This is a bit of a garbage culture in terms of we just burn through stuff fast.
Yeah, we're not fucking.
But on the other hand, we're advertising and marketing and looking for the next shiny new thing. Always have been. So is that the answer to happiness? Well, the commercials would like to tell you that. On the other hand, there's a lot of people that their livelihood depends on that. So, it's sort of this.
It's not a simple thing.
It's definitely not a simple thing.
Because let's just going back to the idea of this void of manufacturing capacity that's going to occur in the event that enough of this sticks that, you have certain products that just aren't coming in. And it's what do we do? We just not have those in our society anymore? What sort of regulations can be basically stripped out so that it doesn't take 5 years just to create the plan to get something built, that can make these things or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't speak to this at a highly informed level. These are thoughts that I think are much like the people who are experiencing this time together, which is you get these little nuggets along the way and it kind of tilts a thought that way. And you hear something in a week and it tilts a thought that way. And you're just ultimately, I think what we're all doing is just soldiering on.
We have to. The demand will always be there. It's coming. And because I sell to the manufacturing sector, when I first got in the industry, it was big business, long-term contracts, steady. I'm using, 100,000 of these every single month, like clockwork. Now, people say, I need this now, and I need this many, and I'll let you know when I need more. And it's smaller buys, and it's quicker turns, and this is what's right in front of me. I'll let you know when I need more. And it's...
When did you see that start to occur?
Oh, gosh. I mean, during the great offshoring in the early 2000s, which was 20 years ago. So,
isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. But, it was sort of the opening of China. And we saw some big manufacturers move from Eastern Europe to Mexico to China. I mean, these are huge corporations within a pretty quick time making consumer goods like video games and whatnot. Just, when China really opened up and we were doing some products for manufacturing and automated screw machine stuff. And they said, well, basically why don't you factor labor at 25 cents an hour? But really it's probably more like 10 cents an hour. Granted, this was 20 years ago, but that's basically free. So
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's that's something that if you can't beat them, join them at that point in time, which is you're not thinking about, what's good. I know is right now I can get those for basically nothing and sell for this.
And that's why I got into this business is out of college, I went to work for a friend of my dad's, good friend, and he had a distribution and rep company for the self-clinching fastener. At the time, they were the biggest in the world. And he was doing really well. And there was these big contracts that they were doing for all these big companies. And so that's what I got into and opened up an office for him in the Pacific Northwest and got salespeople under me, had inside salespeople under me, had a nice warehouse.
Now we're rolling.
We were very profitable. Yeah, and then he sold it and cashed out in 2000 and made a ton. And, you know, good for him. He's nicest guy in the world. I love him to death. Still keep in contact with him. Anyway, so and then I went and repped a company. And was repping basically the same thing, but I was taking on other lines too. Opened up an office for them, brought in salespeople. But then the company owner's like, because I was a rep, I was straight commission. Mm-hmm. And I started to get some pretty good checks, and he couldn't get around that. And so he tried to move my deal.
Oh, he's just like, this guy's killing it. And
yeah. And I'm like,
I just don't want to be paying that.
Right. I'm like, I am a function of sales. Like, you're not paying my health benefits. You're not doing anything. I am merely a percentage on your margin.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, I am a percentage of your sales. So,
it's a tried and true thing.
Exactly. Like, yeah, I don't get it. And you know, coming from that background, I have reps and I am all about writing them checks. Because I know that the more they sell, the more I sell.
Yeah.
So, you know.
You get over it.
Yeah. I'd love to write you a big check, you know. So, anyway, let me circle back around to that. And so when the primary product that I sell, which is the self-clinching fastener, which was formerly listed on the New York Stock Exchange and had the inventor and the family was the ownership group, sold out to a private equity company. And they shuttered a lot of capacity and moved it back over to China and raised the prices. And that's when I really saw a collapse of the industry as for sheet metal fabrication. A lot of these big projects were moving offshore and the ma and pa shops were like a house of cards. It was horrible and because these are hardworking people. They're making stuff. It's, you know, great people. And honestly, that's what's kept me in this industry. Is the people. I really, really enjoy working with people who they're making stuff and you know, creating. They're genuine.
And they give a shit.
Yeah.
Like they really care about what goes out their door.
Yeah. Yes. So then I've got a brother-in-law who's a chemical trader. He goes, by the way, I've got this database. It tells you who's making what and whatever and import records. And I said, let me take a look at that. And so that's when I started manufacturing my company. So we started using in certain factories are good at certain things. And I started to vertically integrate and we started branding Clinch Engineering Fasteners, which is the sheet metal fastener. And the whole idea was to make American, like I said, make America, made in America again, because once we get the bill of materials on the equal level, we can start making stuff again here.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just lost my train of thought on that.
No, it's all right. Yeah. And we can pull back there when you get there. But turning the conversation slightly towards, we were talking earlier, and just at a high level, and we'll backfill, which is, will supply chains truly go digital regarding the discovery, meaning finding it, getting it priced, and just do everything over the computer or their phone or whatever, or ERP to ERP, server to server, however you want to think about it, will it truly just become digital? And just kind of a yes or no.
Yeah, we talked about this, and the answer is yes. And my wife said, don't say this. Don't say yes and no, because it's an answer I give her all the time, yes and no. In many ways, yes. And I see that going, yes. And I'm excited about your product.
Yes.
Yes. Because I see that as the future.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We feel the same way. And it's an interesting thing. So I'll give you, since you asked, I'll give you my opinion on this, which is it's going to be similar to how other verticals have shaken out, which is, let's take online travel, buying an airline ticket. If I just need to fly to Houston, I'll probably just handle that myself, right? But if I'm going to be leaving the country, going to multiple countries, I'm probably going to get a travel agent just because I don't know what I don't know at that point. Right. And I don't want to end up, you know, wherever I don't want to end up. And so I would bring in somebody who knows it. And I'd probably want to talk to them and be like, all right, is this person a dipshit or not? And book my travel that way because they know a lot more. But I think in general, you know, let's say a trip from St. Louis to Houston, let's call that a commodity trip. That's an easy trip for me to book. And there are parallels, I think. There are differences, but parallels into supply chains, which is for a buyer of whatever their company is doing, there are items that fell, you know, the bell curve of products that are kind of in the middle. And, yeah, they know where to get them, but it's really not worth their time anymore to go out and source those in a traditional way. Because where things are more common and more spec'd out is where online, digital, or marketplaces are going to work best for you because you're going to have the most companies that have it. Now, when you reach out to the bell ends of the bell curve, it becomes more exotic. Really, online trade is you can do it there, but in your vertical, everyone knows the three people that have that. Everyone knows the three people that have that, but everything in between, it's like there's a whole gaggle that have it. So why step into that and just let a platform can just sort that out for you? Like what takes 3 hours now takes a minute.
Yes.
So that's a bit of my soapbox, but
yeah, stand on it.
Yeah, I did. I did. I stand on it, and I can't. I got a foot on it still in case I need to get back up. But having said that, which is a bit of a preamble to give you some of my thinking for you to react to, as far as what your thoughts are on, is there partitioning of how digital trade will work, or do you think it just ultimately at the highest level can all go digital?
I think it depends on the end user in many cases. We talked about this earlier where you can get a guy in who helps these big companies source all their stuff, and that's his job. I sell to a lot of smaller fabricators. They still like to fax orders in.
Yeah.
And so for them to embrace the digital age is a little tougher. And, you know, the company that I work for directly for or as a distributor for or as a factory rep for, they're trying to quash any competitors for intellectual property. So it's one of those things where they don't even they sued me. So I can't even produce a cross-reference chart. I mean, they're just going to throw the book at you and keep you down and keep the price up. And that's what they do. So, I'm in a really, really niche area. So,
yeah,
I don't even know if I can say this. We might have to delete this, but you know, it's one of those things where I sort of had to kowtow to them because I'm not going to take on a $1 billion private equity company who has an army of attorneys that are there to, you know, keep things in their favor.
To help you find the error of your way.
Yeah. Either you step in line or we will,
Well, there's something you're touching on what I think is a larger topic, which is I said just the other day, it's been sort of a generational thing of, one was the first B2B platform created for the metals industry, probably in 1996 or something like that. You know, you had e-metals that came from U.S. Steel, I think it was. So you had these early manifestations of these things. So you're looking at like a 30-year period that it's taken for a team to figure this out.
Right.
And we have figured out, we've cracked this code, we have people using this completely autonomously, and it's becoming their main mode of purchasing and selling. But what was the key to that is the question. Time is one of them, right? You had to have certain technologies develop and mature so that there was enough trust in them. Like take fintech, for instance, online payments. Like you had to have that mature. I think consumer habits had to mature first before you would see a jump to business habits, meaning that people are more comfortable risking their own money online than they are their company's money online, because if they fuck that up, they will have no money, right? So they want to first get comfortable at this smaller personal level before they're ever going to suggest at a company level, you should try this. So I think just the maturation or the evolution of e-commerce in a general sense had to occur in a B2C context before it would bleed over into B2B. So I think there's a time is something that is part of that. And so you can't discredit someone for trying, because we've learned, I've read all those postmortems. I'm a total student of this and dissected every single one of those things. But I think the kind of the biggest thing that we had COVID, which accelerated, as talked about, sort of expedited people's willingness to explore something else. Meaning it wasn't because they were at home. It was just because inventory was drying up quickly.
We both did well because of COVID.
Yeah, I think that it, but not in the way that is generally discussed, meaning that a lot of people might tell you that their B2C platform started doing really well because people are home, they're bored or whatever, and they started using things they wouldn't otherwise use. Ours was more about what happens to the commodities markets and things like that. I mean, oil goes negative in March, I think. That month in 2020, I think, goes negative.
Oh, yeah, you could buy oil for less than the cost of a barrel.
Yeah, it was negative. And so there were just these things that were occurring, and you had sellers that couldn't give metal away, and all of a sudden they're like, hey, what's the name of your platform? You know, trying to get on there. But I think that, you know, one of the key things that paved the way was just – the speed of it, which I don't think was ever really a focus. It's like, it's got to be. And I remember the moment of thinking, I remember I saw somebody text a PO to somebody one time, and I said, wow, that was fast. We have to be faster. And that's like that, because if, you know, if you have time, cost, and quality, there's another one, which is just like the speed of getting it done, of all the things being equal. So I think there's a lot that makes it work. It is not straightforward.
Yeah, a lot of moving pieces there.
So you guys have e-commerce.
We are based on an e-commerce platform, and it's actually a relatively common one. But we molded it to what we need, and it's been working. I mean, we've got some tweaks now all of a sudden, but that it's common within mm-hmm. technology. But it's nice to be able to, for someone to just get onto our website, see what we have, see what inventory is, see what it costs. And you know, there's always product in movement, because I know that our value is in having inventory. And so we have products on the move to us all the time. So one of the things that I tell our regular customers is, if you don't see it in the store, let me know, because we have product on the way all the time. And so I don't put it on the store unless it's something I could ship that day.
Right.
You know, I don't want to put anything on there like, oh, yeah, well, it's, you know, in the port, or, you know, it's en route, or no, it's, we could ship it now. So then that's what we do on our platform.
And so is your platform, this is something I've discovered, or it's very obvious, like I discovered, is that a lot of e-commerce industrial businesses are still sort of doing the same old game, which is, they put their price out there. They know it's kind of high, because they still ultimately want you to pick up the phone and call them. And so are you truly trying to get someone to check out online? Or are you kind of saying, hey, we've got this stuff, but it'd be better if you called us so we kind of really understand what's going on here?
Not really. You know, I'll get somebody who will buy what we have and say, do you have any more? Or they will send an email. And it's nice, because we do have so many different SKUs in stock that I pull in new business all the time. You know, new people are like, oh, my gosh, you have this. I've been looking for this. But they mm-hmm. didn't know about this. And it took the meta words for them to find it. So
right. And so what's the loyalty like on the e-commerce site?
I think when we get the customers, it's pretty good. Okay. I mean, we have certainly have the barrier of entry is getting people to move away from their old supplier.
So it's the incumbent.
It's the incumbent. And I think that a lot of people are And they're also big, and these are billion-dollar companies that are the incumbents now. They've all sort of conglomerated down to a few big power players, and these buyers can go in and say, give me everything. Mm-hmm. And so they can at a cost. And so I deal a lot with some of the shops that they still do decent volume, but they are also looking at their bottom line. And so this is a way for them to come in at a lower price and be more competitive, because their number two cost is going to be my commodity. You know, number one being the raw material sheet stock itself. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we're sort of number two on that. And, you know, when you talk about the overall cost of a fixture of what it takes to manufacture that, that will make them a winner if they're going after OEM business.
Did you start Clinch Northwest as an e-commerce business, or have you morphed into one? Did you have sales?
No, it was always e-commerce. And it was actually a friend of mine who had an e-commerce platform who helped guide it. Now, he sold that company, and so we moved over to another platform called WooCommerce. And, and right now we're having a little bit of a struggle, because right now it maxes people out. Like, oh, we show you've got 300,000 in stock, but I can only put 9,990 in my shopping cart. I had that happen for a company that's now supplying Peterbilt trucks right now. And I'm like, oh, geez, we got to get in there. We got to do some software development on that. So, you know, because it's and I don't know exactly how WooCommerce works, but I think it's an open source type platform. So we can do some software tweaks on it. So I am going to be looking at getting some software guys in there to make it better for us, for our consumers.
I mean, they put an upper limit on the quantity that somebody can check out.
Yeah, and I don't know how that happened or why that happened, but suddenly people are asking me like, oh, and I'm like, let me go back, let me audit it. We could get that product out to you, because it shows we have it stock. It just won't letting you put it into our shopping cart. So that's just
That sounds like a good problem to have. I mean,
options. But you know what? You get a billion-dollar corporation saying, what's up? How come I can do this? You don't want that to happen. I want it to be seamless all the way through. And so as a principal at a company or the owner or the founder, you want everything to be easy. You want somebody to come in and say, I love these guys. They make it easy. There's no problems.
Yeah. You want it to be as though they don't even know they did it.
Right.
You know, I always think of like a water slide. Once you're on it, you know, it's really fun going down it. And you don't want to get off. And so that's how we want our products to be, which is just nice laminar flow, really good experience. And, you know, I don't know anyone that likes a slower water slide. You know, so we want to make a good fast one that people can't wait to get back up to
exactly.
The top.
They want to run to the top and do it again.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're working on that.
So back to this kind of overarching concept of digital. I think that, you know, if we brought 10 people in here and ask them, hey, do you think it's going to go digital? How many do you think would say yes?
All of them.
You think all of them?
I think all of them will. And you can have some resistors. And it also depends on who you're bringing in, I suppose. I mean, the non-digital age is aging out.
So, they really are.
Yeah. And it's funny because you go in a lot of shops, there's not a lot of young people in there unless it's a really – it depends on the industry, but you know, these people are starting to retire. The younger people are coming in. They've already are well versed in the digital age, and so moving that way is bringing. I mean, I would imagine there's young people are coming into some of these companies and saying, "Why are you even doing this?" You know,
I think that's a big part of our thinking, which is. Yeah, we brought in the same designers that, you know, do Samsung, Apple, like the best designers for this release we're about to do, because I view it as a bit of a problem that companies in supply chains have trouble attracting talent and retaining talent just because their software systems are just not the latest and greatest, let's say, and not kids, but people who are starting their careers want to be someplace where they feel like they're part of the action and they're using the best and the best things are available to them. And one of my goals has been like, I want people who thought they wanted to go into some other industry, see what the shit that's coming out our door and be like, I want to be in the metals world.
I agree. And I think that shift has to come, more automation, more digitization.
Yeah.
And that will come.
Yeah.
But we got to push it. We're the generation that has to do that.
I think we are the generation that is doing that. I'd say it's here. Yeah. I mean, what we're about to release, there won't be a better version. It is so well, like, it's going to be on par with the newest operating system on your phone. It's that well done. And I really look forward to hearing the comments of, you know, in my head, I'm hoping that they're good. Obviously, there are people who say, I wish you'd done this, wish you'd done that. But in general, we love this, right?
Right.
And people really feeling like now they're part of like an industry that's cool, happening, advancing, and, you know, retaining the talent because they have the best systems. And I think kids, I keep saying kids, and that may be because I'm just getting old, but like younger, the younger workers, they seem to have less tolerance for things that are inefficient, right? So sitting there and, you know, kind of meticulously pushing something around your desk could be done in 1 second. It's like, why am I doing this?
I don't think the younger generation has the attention span for that.
Well,
the patience. They just want to move it on. If it can be efficient at it, be efficient at it.
Yeah, and I think that as this younger generation was coming into the workforce, we viewed that as they don't have an attention span and da 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 da. But now it's getting to a point where it's like you look at that and they're like, well, why should they for something that could be done something in 1 second? Like maybe part of that's actually smart that they're like, yeah, if we can do something, can do it better and faster and gets the same result, why would I not do that?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can give you philosophical reasons, but if like in the context of like, hey, I'm just trying to get this done so that our company can get something out the door or whatever, and there's no sacrifice to doing it, you know, why would you not?
Yeah. And there's programs out there that my competitor does where they can take a drawing and spit out a bill of materials. And,
sure.
And it goes directly to their companies because they are starting to vertically integrate that way. So at a big cost. I would think that AI will be able to figure that out and then give you the low cost, you know.
I don't think AI is going to – well, from a pricing perspective, I don't think AI is going to be in a hurry to get in the B2B transactional world.
Yeah, probably not.
There's too much risk, like way too much. But I think there'll be everything around it,
right,
which is what has driven many of our decisions here, which is where is AI going to be and where is it not going to be? Right. And what do you want to focus on that you think you can find a seam where AI is not likely to want to involve itself?
I think AI is going to want to involve itself in everything as long as you allow it to.
Mm-hmm.
So the evolution of that is to be determined, but it's touching our lives now and it will be touching our lives even more as we move forward.
What are the top three, stepping outside of the metals industry, what are the top three industries that you think are going to be the most affected by AI? Let me back up. Do you use AI personally?
You know, I really don't. You know, we just went through a thing, and unfortunately, I lost my mother, mm-hmm. pancreatic cancer, and my sister who does like SVP communications and C-level executives.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, we're going to do all this AI. Like, what are you even like putting the obituary through to coming up with a timeline to, she ran everything through AI just to give it a quick pass. And of course she reviews it, but you know, it took the task time and the time that it took for, you know, it just takes it down. In terms of her ability to create content, it takes the time, you know, it sort of eliminates that. So
yeah, it doesn't take it down, it eliminates it.
Yeah, yeah.
Sam Altman went to school about a half a mile from here.
Oh, no kidding.
The guy, yeah, the CEO of ChatGPT and John Hamm right there.
No kidding.
Yeah, they crank him out over there. Same school.
Okay.
But anyway, so top three industries that you think that are going to be – most affected, and we won't quote you on this, but I mean, the rate at which it's getting smarter is staggering. So who knows what it might be able to do.
Right. And I just know what I've read, which is, okay, lawyers, you know, the legal, the ability to do a legal brief or understand it or, you know, put that together, I guess. I don't know.
I'd be shitting bricks if I were an attorney.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
They got to review it. You got to review it. Everything's got to be, you got to have a good set of eyes on it.
I agree with that. But the drafting of contracts, which is what takes really the longest amount of time, is getting it drafted correctly. And then reviewing it is sort of, yeah, looks good. And you can find the one or two things. But, you know, if you're creating a private placement memorandum or something like that, it's not the review that takes a long time. You know, it's creating the content that goes into that takes a long time. How do you want to properly articulate, you know, the risks, right, or the opportunity or track records? How, you know, creating the content to populate a document like that is what takes the month and a half of working on it. And not the, okay, final review are all the sort of must-haves in here. You know, that part takes, you know, if you're working on a PPM for a month and a half, maybe a week of it would be that review.
Correct. I could see that. Yes. You know, honestly, I'm not that close to AI to know.
Okay.
And I haven't really looked into it. I don't know. You tell me. What do you think?
What do I think will happen?
Yeah. Well, I mean, other than the legal industry.
I think
AI.
I think that a lot of industries along those lines, and it's not because legal is not good at what they, attorneys are great at what they do. But I think their involvement is going to be in a review capacity. Now, litigation is a different thing. Set that to the side. I mean, that's a whole different thing. But just corporate law, as far as creating contracts and agreements and writing memorandums and things like that, I think it's going to become very much a review basis. I think that you might maybe could say the same thing for accounting, you know, when you're pulling stuff together for that. I think clearly marketing, there are huge implications in the marketing world.
Correct.
You know, it's like, how do you begin to discuss how much? Just talk about the concept of content or, you know, creating images. What is the impact going to be for, like, Adobe stock photos or, you know, all these places that have stock images? When you buy those images, you're typically settling for something that's sort of like what you want.
But you can now suddenly make
exactly what you want. And it's part of your monthly subscription. You're not paying anything for that image because you've already used, you know, that AI, whichever platform you used, 5,000 times that month. And you're well probably ahead of, like, the value prop. Like, you've earned it. And I think in marketing, it's huge. I mean, as far as name an aspect of marketing, I think it's now, what I don't think it'll be able to do is it won't be able to rally people the way like a good promoter can. And promoting and marketing are different things, but like the personalities that it takes to get certain movements to occur or things like that, you know, kind of bucketed in marketing, but I think it's going to be promotions a different ball of wax. And I think you need the right person delivering, whether maybe ChatGPT wrote that content, but the right person delivering it.
Right.
It's always, yeah. I think there has to be a role for that person who can do
Brizos.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. Brizos. Come on, man. Get your medal.
Yeah. Get your medal on. Yeah. And the people think metal is just so boring. If it's like, look around you, anyone who's listening, look around the room you're in. And there's just
metal.
Yeah, it's probably holding you up right now. You know, it's everywhere.
Keeping your pants on.
It's keeping your pants on. And but anyway, I think that...
Unless it's Spanx.
But maybe they've got, you know, maybe some copper tone, like woven in.
Copper bracelets.
Yeah, things woven into the fabric. I've no idea. But I think when back to supply chains, I think the implications or the utility of AI, I think, is massive.
Yeah.
As far as design, you know, what is it going to do for people who sit there and pore over trying to draw something in CAD? And now you can say, hey, I just need this thing, generate. And it comes out as a CAD drawing.
That's true. And it's, what's funny is that, you know, I spent a long time as a factory representative, and so I worked with a lot of engineering and design teams. And getting it into production, I talked also to the production people, too, who are making stuff out of metal. And they're like, this guy has no idea what our capacity is to make something and make it easy. And so I guess AI can close that gap. You know, when you're doing a, you know, a CAD drawing of like, this is what I want, and this is how I need to this is the most effective way to manufacture it.
Most effective way. And you don't even have to, you can just explain the circumstance of like, hey, I need a piece made, fabbed up that is going to be between this one and that one. And it'll say, oh, here, use this.
Yeah.
And you can export it and, you know, here's your bill of material. And we priced it. The price is going to suck, but we did price it.
Right.
And, you know, get you almost all the way there. So that, you know, it's the implications and consequences, I'd say, are pretty far-reaching at a minimum. And, I mean, not to say software development is going to get absolutely, like, the people who are just sitting there coding at, you know, consulting companies about coding software, I would say, are really their job is not going to be if knowing how to code. It's going to be, do I know how to harness ChatGPT or Grok or whatever these other ones are to make sure that your software turnaround is fast and as accurate as humanly possible? So something that would have taken 3 months to develop should take less than a week.
Yes.
And it should be fully tested and finished.
Yeah. I can see that.
It's mind-boggling.
Right.
What it does and the rate at which it's getting better is, we use AI constantly, you know, and much of what we do is.
Are you using it in your software development?
And now and again, yeah. Okay. I think I use it really more as like my assistant, kind of, which is if I'm thinking through something, I'll bounce ideas off of it and help me think through it.
Okay.
You know, can extrapolate thought very quickly. And say, well, what is the logical conclusion based on these constraints of the circumstance?
I wonder if I can get that to interface with what I'm doing, where I can do something where someone can send a print and say, I want to make 10,000 of these.
100%.
What do I need on my bill of materials? And where I could offer that to a customer through AI.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, my opinion is that AI is not going to get into pricing. It may give a price. But I don't think they're going to want to get into B2B transactions anytime soon because the dollar amounts and the suits that could come from an error there are much different.
Yeah.
As soon as you have something physically moving in as a result of a piece of software, it's different.
Someone's got to touch it.
Yeah, someone's got to touch it. And if things go wrong and that's come across an AI platform, which is really just supposed to be a large language model, is that really more than they want to bite off,
right?
You know, and I think that a lot of distributors and others who are going to be protectionists and say, well, we're going to keep an eye on whatever that bullshit AI index is, and we'll just make sure that it's wrong so that the business still comes directly to us.
Okay.
I would think. You know, I don't think they're going to hand it over quickly.
Well, your platform, someone obviously has to touch it. Mm-hmm. It's not all AI, but it's an online marketplace for metal. And you put out there what you want, and someone comes back and says, this is what I'm able to do it, or multiple people come back.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have a buyer who checks out, and they can find what they want instantly, and it's priced and availability. It's instant. And then how
do the sellers get their pricing onto that? They're like, this is what we're selling, this is what we need, or how
they
does that...
don't.
No?
We tell them this is the price. Now, the beautiful thing is what we've done that is helping this work the way that it's working is we've removed the largest threat, which is a race to the bottom.
Got it.
So one of the key elements is that sellers cannot undercut other sellers.
Okay.
Right? And that's a huge piece of the puzzle, is that if you have that's just been the major gripe from a seller standpoint, and it's real, which is it's not our job to interfere with the seller's ability to capitalize on an inventory investment. That's not our job. Our job is to open a conduit through which transactions flow.
Got it.
And there's a huge difference. One, I mean, so it's more of a market-making mechanism than a marketplace mechanism. But that's because that's kind of, it's not semantic. It's true. I mean, it's true. But it's something that people don't much give a shit about. You know, they're like, oh, market maker, marketplace, whatever. We just, it's where we go. So we don't really discuss it. But there are all these little, I mean, the whole thing is esoteric, right? But there are all these little dynamics that are there to address the idiosyncratic nature of this vertical, right? Which I believe exists in adjacent verticals. I mean, I think that as cool as we all think our verticals are, and they are cool, but they're not all that different than the ones next to them.
Correct. Right?
Which is you have something that gets ordered. You have something that gets put on a truck. You have something that gets somewhere. It gets offloaded. Somebody looks at it and says, this is right or wrong. If it's right, an invoice gets paid. You know?
Almost all commodities are like that. Everything.
Well,
really.
I mean, anything that's being bought, you know, unless it's in the same room, I guess you have to put it on a truck. You know, like if I'm buying a baseball ticket, they're just going to hand it to me through the window. But in general, you just have something that's like in, up, and out. And it's what it comes down to really is just sort of what jargons exist within certain verticals. How do they talk about things more than what's mechanically occurring? You know, net terms isn't something that's like specific to the metals industry, you know? So I think that, I don't know. I think, I don't know where I started on that thought, Mike.
But I detoured you right into that. I was asking you about that. So,
and yeah, but anyway, I think that how you asked me, how does it really work on the sell side, is it's one of the key components of what we do is that we don't ask anybody for anything.
Right.
Right. We are the knowers of the market is the position we have chosen to take. And I don't mean that from a, we know more than you. We've had to take that position because if we've got to lubricate this market, and if sellers don't want races to the bottom, you know, then that's an issue. And if buyers want instant access to pricing and availability, that's a problem. So it's like, how do you get these things, these two people to play together in a world where they may have otherwise not been friends?
I see.
And get that to happen digitally.
Right. For the seller's perspective, is what you're saying.
Well, just buyers and sellers, it's the understanding that buyers and sellers are very different organisms, right? They're often thought of as the same thing, but just on different sides of the transactions. But their motivations are essentially the same, which is they're trying to get a transaction to occur. Okay, and that's true, but the way they want it to occur, meaning the courting process, is very different on both sides of that, which is strange because ultimately they're choking through the transaction ring together.
Well, I used to always say it all flows downhill to us because nothing happens on either end of the company unless this buyer and seller transaction happens.
Yes. This non-friendship needs to be consummated.
but really, you know, you've got a buyer who's buying so many different things. And nobody recognizes the fact that, you know, they might have placed 100 purchase orders that day to get every single thing flowing throughout the entirety of this giant company or even small company. And it's only when the one thing goes bad or sideways that, you know, they suddenly get into a lot of trouble and recognize, wait a minute, what about the other 10,000 things that I did? But
yeah.
Then again, a lot of it is also coming back to what's going on the production floor. Hey, we're down to our last one. And we need to get this job out this afternoon.
Yeah. We got a problem. And that shit happens.
All, it, all the time. And I tell companies that I work with that are manufacturing, I'm like, you know, the company down the street has the same problem. And if you change companies, you're just changing names of the people who are delivering those problems to you. Because there seems to be something endemic about the ability to cap all those things. And I mean, if you look at Toyota did the Pokeyoke, and there's the Kaizen and all these things about efficiencies and making mm-hmm. way to make manufacture things. Things are always kind of, and it's usually a human error. And maybe that's something that AI can fix.
Well, you've all heard the saying, read the work order, right? When you're having to go through that, the process, which I hate all rear view mirror activity, but you got to go back and you got to find out, okay, what's the root cause analysis, all that bullshit that I hate doing, which is every second we're focusing on that.
Well, it's preventative. It's called a corrective action for a reason. And that's part of our, like when we were ISO certified for that very reason, as they went through and it's like, okay, what are your processes?
Yeah.
And how are you going to make that error proofed?
Yeah. Typically, it comes down to what we found. It was just kind of a moment of like, I just lost my attention for a second. What are we going to do? Like put shock collars on or shock things on their wrists just to fucking keep them dialed in literally every second of their day. And so it's my point being that it's, I don't know. I just don't like looking back. You know, you don't want to look in the rearview mirror. I don't mean that as like, hey, why don't we go forward? I mean, it's just not a good use of company time. So as you're constructing, that's the other problem with like sort of business has been around for a while. When you go through and you are evaluating the operations and you say, well, why do we do it that way? Well, you say, well, that's how we did it that one day when we did it. And we've done it ever since for the last 20 years. So if there's a greater mindfulness put towards the creation of these operational activities versus like, oh, and it also happens in distribution where you want to be sort of this high repeat shop where every day, you want to get this point where every day is the same, right? We just went in and monitored the system and it all worked great in distribution. But there's always these customers that pull you into this custom world of like, oh, they like it exactly this way. So you have these different processes of operation being created on the fly as these different types of customers come in that need it done this way. And they get sort of just MacGyvered along the way, and you turn around 10 years later, and you have all of these air pockets inside of these operational processes. Yeah.
Right. It is interesting. Especially from a job shop perspective where you are getting pulled in a bunch of different directions. So we do the same thing essentially every day. And so generally when the errors occur, it's because a guy's in a hurry and he's not paying attention. And so we're like, okay, we have these processes in place. You know, if we don't get it out that day, I'd rather get it out right and get it out tomorrow. Because if you get it out wrong today, that's a huge hiccup. And
yeah,
I had a buddy who got a horse, really rare horse, and he wanted to get it trained up by this guy. He was like the cowboy horse whisperer, and he went. He's okay. When can I, you know, when can I ride my horse? When can I do all this stuff? And he goes, it's gonna take as long as it takes, and it's not gonna, you know, and.
You know
what did he say? Yeah. He had a saying for it. It was like, it takes as long as it takes, and it's not going to take any faster. In other words, if you rush the process, you're really going to set yourself back,
right?
Because that's when you got to hit every single hoop as you go through and do the process correctly to make it work.
Have you seen these unmanned warehouses before? Unmanned forklifts, unmanned everything. The whole thing's like a Roomba, and it just goes around and picks orders. It's like out of the Jetsons, right? There are no people in there.
I've got, you know, there's a factory in China that I actually get some product from. They make rivets, And I couldn't believe how automated it was. And it was a similar thing. You know, they had all the lot codes and test stuff for their rivets, yet they had a guy trimming the bushes and the grass out front with a pair of scissors.
Right. Well, they wanted to free up some budget for the bushes.
Anyway, yeah, that's pretty remarkable.
Well, it sort of seems like a sign of things to come, which is these inventories are so nailed down and they're so accurate and so well coded. And, you know, they're pushing up all this coding and so forth up to the manufacturing level. So when they even hit their warehouse, these things are already, you know, RFID, barcoded, whatever you want to use to recognize it. They already hit their shop that way. And these things, these forklifts can scan it on the way in and stock it. And just need, it's like a giant vending machine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I was on a seeing an engineering firm and they were making RFID tags for fish.
Yeah.
And it would, you know, go down a chute, boom, get an RFID tag, send it out. If it didn't go through, fish came around to go to get another tag.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What are the fish like that?
Probably salmon. I don't know.
They don't care.
They don't care. Any fish.
Yeah. I mean, the fish don't care.
No. I mean, my address, I actually share with a fish tag manufacturing company.
Do you?
Yeah. Floyd Tag.
Yeah. Floyd Tag.
Crustaceans, sharks, billfish, they're involved in fisheries all over the world.
Really?
Yeah.
And yeah. It's just...
And there's a bunch of gals in there making tags all day long.
Things I don't think about.
Right. Somebody's got to make the fish tags.
Somebody's got to tag those fish.
You know, well, they also like... I know the fishing game because some buddies just came back from a fly fishing trip in Idaho and... They caught one of the tags, and it was from the Idaho Fish and Game, and they actually, if you send it in, you get a little gift certificate, and some of them are worth money.
Yeah.
Or you get put into a lottery, I think is what it does, so people report them.
The duck hunters always are like, I shot a tag duck or something. They always, you know, it's an extra layer of excitement when you get one that's tagged.
Tagged.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's exciting. I don't
So are you a duck hunter?
Occasionally.
Okay, so I know with the fish and game, if you turn the tag in, you go in for a lottery.
Okay.
And that's the enticement for you to report the tag. You know, where you caught it, you know, what was the size of the fish or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, or maybe give the note and send it back and put the fish in the water. I don't know exactly how that works. I didn't ask. But is there something like that for the duck?
You know, I don't know. I've never shot a tag duck. And I don't know. I don't know if there's a full loop like that. Or not, because I don't know if they're RFID. I think they just put like a metal band kind of around the leg, kind of right about, you know, at the ankle effectively. It's tagged, and I think they probably want them to report that tag just for, for ecology reasons. You know, this was, you know, this was shot here at this place at this date and so forth. So understand migration, whatever they're interested in knowing, yeah. You know. I don't know how the full feedback works. So other things about digital that are on your mind as you're looking into either the present or the future. I mean, we've got tariffs, which I know we're all just sort of moving around and, you know, it's sort of rolling with the punches. And also being more proactive than that, obviously. But what other sort of digital topics kind of cross your mind as you go through your days?
Ooh. It doesn't, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we're so involved in just getting the day-to-day business done, whether it's incoming information, outgoing information, meeting a customer's needs. The digitization, we've got a platform. I've got somebody who helps, you know, figure that out. I'm learning all the time, and I think that our industry is very old school, and so it's something where I look at something like what you're doing, and I'm like, I need to embrace this.
Mm-hmm.
I was a bartender in college, and I bartended at a nightclub.
What was your best drink?
You know what? Back then in Washington, it was just beer and wine, which made it really simple.
Yeah.
And the group of guys who – there was a group. There was like 22 investors in this club. And they were all late 20s, And they'd all put in a little handful of money. It was very popular. All the teams went down there after the games. You know, the Sounders, Sonics, the
What's the
Seahawks.
Local beer there?
Oh, man. It was Microbrew Central.
Okay.
So it wasn't like the cheap beers. It was the, you know,
it wasn't like
Red Hook before they got bought by Anheuser-Busch, or it was, you know, Windermere, you know, Portland Breweries.
Did Single Speed come out of that area?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. We had 20-something beers on tap, and, of course, remember Zuma's? Was it Zima?
Zima.
That was, you know.
It came out of your area?
No, it didn't come out of it, but that was the era of, like, you know, Bartles and James.
I would say that was immediately Bartles and James.
Yeah, exactly.
The wine coolers.
It was just the beginning of that. But there was one of the guys there who was like, there's this online bookstore. They're looking for seed capital.
Yeah.
You know, Nick Hanauer, you know, who's he sort of found all these. He's a multi-billionaire now, and then anybody who invested in this online bookseller, which was Amazon, ended up just, you know, blowing up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I look at something like you're doing, like, okay, this is a niche that
this is one of those things.
I think this is one of those things, you know, and I think it shares a lot of excitement in the ability to service the customer. So,
and I think what we're doing well is being patient, as far as, like, we're from the industry, so we get what our proposition represents, you know, in trying to do it in a way that is not offensive but accretive, meaning people look at it and, like, I can see how I can use this for my business, versus being like, I'm just going to pretend I never saw that.
Right.
You know, such as back to the concept of eliminating racists to the bottom, you know. That's
important.
It's everything.
Because that has integrity and making sure that somebody's just not coming in and dumping a truckload and getting out.
Yeah, and that's so. That they're just – it's not based on merit. It's look, we've specialized in the transactional deal flow versus something like the project or contract. And, you know, there's not a ton of loyalty in the transactional day-to-day buys and sells. Right. But what we do is we sort of give this a little bit more of a formality, a little bit more structure in the sellers, because the whole idea has been, if a seller is going to fail on here on a given transaction, they have to fail fast. So they don't have any sort of time lost in that, because that's when platforms get sort of, you know, run out of town is, hey, I invested all my time in uploading all of this. I invested my time making sure everything was ready for sale, and then nothing happened. And now I hate this place. You know, so the concept is, you have to make sure that buyer and seller, if it doesn't work, they can say to themselves, well, I didn't put anything into it. And so that's, you're willing to come back, because it then becomes all upside when it does work.
That's what you want. Ease.
Yeah, and absolutely frictionless.
Set it and forget it, as Ron Popeil would say.
Is Ron still with us?
I don't think he is. We lost Ron.
From Ronco?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, remember it. Set it and forget it.
Set it and forget it.
A game changer. I never used one.
I didn't either. I think I might have had some Ronco products in the 70s.
I think I had a Foreman. I don't even know if that's the same product, but
I don't think so. Rest in peace, George Foreman.
What?
Isn't he still? Isn't he Chaz?
No way.
Oh,
I don't know. I'm not as in tune as I want to be.
We're just old.
Tune as I want to be.
Yeah.
So back to the idea of, like, you were up in Seattle, bartender, and I pulled you into a
conversation. Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
So, but what was the rest of that? When you were in Seattle, you were bartending.
No, Nick Hanauer was, like, telling all the other investors, because he was an investor in our bar, the bar that I worked at, to invest in Amazon, which was the concept being an online bookseller. That was in 91 or 90. I mean, this is when, you know, Jeff Bezos said, you know, left New York to go to Seattle and was working on doors. As a matter of fact, one of the guys in my office sells doors to Amazon, because they still use them as desks.
Really?
Yes. Yes. Because in our warehouse, I rented this big warehouse space. I think I mentioned that. And I've got some guys in the neighborhood, and one of them is a lumber broker, and he sells doors to Amazon. The door parts that go into Amazon, and they do them for desks.
Really?
Yeah.
They just do like the final cabinet on either side.
I'm sure it's a lot nicer than that, but I think it's sort of this whole symbolic thing about, okay, yeah, this is our beginnings, and this is what we're going to do. So,
yeah, that's, I don't know. I guess that's good. I don't know. It's kind of like the Sam Walton story.
They're kicking,
right,
ass. All I wish I, you know, had the money to invest there, because we wouldn't be talking. I would be, yeah, on the beach somewhere.
No, that's all right. Well, maybe you probably would have gotten bored by now.
Probably. I'd probably be dead, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They may have given you the support you needed to crash your life.
Of glory, exactly. That's what I had to get out of. That's how I got in the fastener business in the first place.
Yeah.
I was like, I need to get out of Seattle and get behind a desk and just sort of like move on. And so,
right,
I met a gal who had already, you know, sort of started her career, and I'm, yeah, like, okay, I need to
step off the fraternity porch.
Exactly.
And maybe get serious about
doing some stuff. And like I said, found myself in the sheet metal fastener industry and enjoyed the people and the commodity and really the whole envelope of it. So,
well, tell me again, because in closing, for those who are listening, how do they find you guys' website, and are they can welcome to go there and just buy as needed, or how's that?
Yeah,
that
well,
work?
We're B2B, so everything, okay, has got to be, you know,
no retail.
No retail. So it's clinchnorthwest.com or clinchnw.com, and we do custom screw machine product, but are specialized in, and we also do custom cold forming, but are specializing in self-clinching sheet metal fasteners, blind rivets. And then we also do distribution of rivet nuts, and then we also work with tools for rivets and rivet nuts also. So, okay, upwards of, you know, robotic automation and sort of next generation type stuff. So
all you can handle.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming in today. It's been really fun talking with you. I think, yeah, we scratched the surface of many things that maybe could lead on to other discussion. But thank you for coming in.
Yeah, it's nice to talk about what I do every day and how we sort of affect the world, because we do. I mean, I probably have products. You probably use my slot machines that I have widgets in, or, you know, if you or. You know, are on a cell phone to product that I've put, you know, I sold to a company that put in the metal box. Or
is there any way someone would know if they're looking at something? Or is it all internal?
It's all internal. Okay. You would never know. And I think I sort of, a self-clinching sheet metal fastener is a hardened fastener with a Rockwell hardness harder than the parent sheet metal material that gets pressed in there. And it's joined onto that, and it's in every single piece of electronic enclosure that you have, because electronics have to be wrapped in metal for RFID, to keep the radio frequency and so it's going to be all around the world. It's everywhere. So
when I'm trying to disassemble something to fix it, and I can't find a way to open it?
You can open it, but the piece that's attached to the metal – you know, the screw that goes into that,
yeah,
that's attached to it, that, you know, it could go into my nut. Or if you have a nut that's onto a stud that's attached to the metal.
Okay.
So, you know, one piece is, undone. I mean, a rivet is something that joins it together, but mine can be undone.
It can.
Yeah.
Okay.
From one end.
If they so choose to make it that way, or just in general?
Just in general. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
All right. I understand. Yeah. Well, thanks again for coming in.
Yeah, thank you, Shep.
And, yeah, talk soon.
Yeah, cheers.